Hey folks, this is Scott Weingart, and you're listening to the MCRIT podcast. Now, if you've listened for any length of time, you know that when it comes to emergent surgical airway, my preference is the knife over the needle. And we've debated this in the past, but some interesting things have been happening in the world of airway management. The Difficult Airway Society, the airway group for the United Kingdom, has recently advocated that the first technique that should be taught and used for what we are now calling front of neck access is the scalpel bougie cricothyrotomy. Now, the Australians still dissent. They're still recommending catheter-based techniques if you're someone not familiar with using a scalpel, but things are going my way. And to further that, I want to bring on an anesthesiologist named Laura Dugan, someone with a particular interest in airway management. She did both anesthesia and pediatric residencies. She did a cardiothoracic fellowship. She now practices as a general and cardiothoracic anesthesiologist in the UK. She spent time in pediatric emergency departments. She is incredible. I got to chat with her at SMAC Dublin, and she was telling me she was about to publish an article on the very high failure rate of transtracheal jet ventilation in can't intubate, can't oxygenate situations. And I said, well, you got to come on the show as soon as the article comes out. So that's what we're going to do today. We're going to have a discussion about that, as well as a app created by Laura and one of her residents that I think is the future of how studies should be done on rarely used techniques. But we'll get to talk about that in a little bit. Before we start, SMAC Before we start, Das Smack, that is Smack in Berlin, tickets are going on sale on the 26th. And I didn't know this was just news to me. Again, this year they're only releasing 2,000 tickets, even though there may be more space than that 2,000. They're only allowing 2,000 because any bigger than that and you kind of lose the community feeling that the SMACs have. So I applaud the organizers for that decision. But how it's going to ramify on you is, yet again, they probably will sell out instantly. So you want to be on the ball. Look around at the SMAC website, at all the affiliated sites. I'll put up a post on MCRIT in the next few days as well, discussing the event. But in short, put it on your calendar. Now, 10/26, tickets go on sale. If you miss that first round, your chances already are markedly diminished for getting tickets because they released the big bolus of tickets in that first round. Okay, enough. Let's get to the show. The first question I want to ask is front of neck access. Are you a fan of the term, or do you think it is really annoying sounding?
Why choose? I think front of neck access, until it's an international acceptable thing to say, can be irritating to some. However, it includes a lot of different techniques. So it's it's a bit of a bucket for a number of things, which I do like, actually. Instead of listing them all out, we can just say FONA. So I do use it when I'm writing. I'm not sure if it's going to be internationally accepted, but I like it.
All right. So then you did a wonderful systematic review on one form of front of neck access, and that's transtracheal jet ventilation. How did you decide to engage in this study?
Well, I have to be honest with you. I mean, when I started my anesthesia residency, we were all given tubes, Luer lock adapters, and told how to do jet ventilation. We attached them all to our stethoscopes, and that's what we went around with. Although I'd never seen anybody do jet ventilation. And when I started to dive a little deeper into it, and that was a decade ago, nobody really even knew what pressure to start with. So I actually wrote a paper about 9 years ago that ended up being a 40-page tome that probably nobody will ever read, and I didn't submit, about all the different animal and in vitro and human studies. It sort of sat on the shelf for a while, and then 2 years ago during my cardiothoracic fellowship, there was a two-week-old baby in a can't intubate, can't ventilate situation, and transtracheal jet ventilation was attempted. Now, I was not in the room for that, but the result of which is her right main stem bronchus was blown apart, and she ended up with pneumocephalus as well. And that really affected me because I think that, you know, we have these guidelines and we're recommended to do these things. So what happens when you do what's recommended and something catastrophic occurs as a result?
Oh my God, I can't even imagine. That's horrible.
Yeah, yeah. So she actually ended up, you know, needing thoracics and she actually ended up doing fairly well. But it did actually motivate me to become more systematic about it. So I went to the librarian at Duke where I was at the time and we started this review. So when I came home, the first thing that I did was actually go to my librarian here at the University of British Columbia and make her my second author to really start diving into the both published and unpublished literature about this to see really its efficacy in this emergency situation where you may only get one shot at salvaging a patient.
So what do you find, Laura?
Well, what we found was in the published and unpublished literature, there wasn't as many cases as we thought there would be, actually. So what we did was we actually set up emergency transtracheal jet ventilation, the number of cases of that we found, and compared them to when transtracheal jet ventilation was used in, quote-unquote, an emergency, if the authors defined it as that, but it wasn't can't intubate, can't oxygenate, in however the authors described it. And then compared it to jet ventilation in the elective surgery situation. And by that, I mean transtracheal. I don't mean through the glottis, but actually transtracheally, which is done mainly in Europe. And what we found was we only found 90 procedures, jet ventilation and can't intubate, can't ventilate, compared those to emergency procedures where it wasn't can't intubate, can't ventilate, and then the elective ones. And what we found, the bottom line being that device failure occurred in 42% of those 90 cases. Barotrauma occurred in one-third, 32% of those 90 cases. And then we had a bunch of miscellaneous complications, cardiovascular collapse, some different things. And so in total, 46 out of the 90 cases had some sort of significant complication, totaling 51% of the cases that we found. And in comparison to either elective situations or emergency situations that jet ventilation was used, but it wasn't can't intubate, can't ventilate, there it was a huge difference, 51% compared to like 7 to 8% for those other situations. So very situationally specific, high complication rate for transtracheal jet ventilation.
Wow. Now, when you say device failure, if I understood the study correctly, that actually refers to potentially misplacement of the cannula as well. Is that correct?
Correct. So device failure was failure to place the cannula in the trachea. But what we also found was a very high incidence of when it was attached to a jet ventilator, i.e., something that provides oxygen that you actually measure with pressure and you don't measure by flow, that essentially things that were attached to each other would blow apart, that you wouldn't get the cannula right in the first place. But even if you did, what you attached it to actually had a high device failure, like the contraption that you set up was a significant contributor to device failure as well.
Now, did this study include these jerry-rigged devices that wouldn't classically be considered jet ventilation, but would just be high-flow ventilation?
No. They had to actually define what their oxygen source was by pressure first, or they had to actually say that they were jet ventilated. But to be honest with you, because we actually had two content experts looking at these papers, even if somebody defined as jet ventilation, then went on to describe it as 5 liters per minute, 10 liters per minute, we actually didn't include those studies. So they actually had to include whether it was KPA or PSI or however you wanted to define pressure. The actual flow of oxygen had to be defined by pressure.
Now that's interesting to me because we could go both ways on that. We could argue on the one hand that if you have one of these devices that measure by pressure, you're already ahead of the game from what many places are doing, which is they're just creating these systems that have never been rigorously tested, and they think that's going to be their salvation in the once in a career can't intubate, can't oxygenate, where this would actually become relevant. And yet, on the other hand, what about all of the patients who did get those devices? We've left those out of the study. What's your thoughts on that?
Well, those would be flow studies. And so we do have a group of those that we're now looking at. what we wanted to do was really focus on the term jet and what we mean by jet. And that in and of itself is an extremely confusing term. As you all know, Andy Hird out of Australia has published on this and published guidelines on this. But looking at his podcasts and looking at his guidelines, even though he calls it jet ventilation, it actually is defined by flow of oxygen. So this is where it gets sort of murky. But this was our first carving of this data to actually just say, let's just use jet ventilation defined as the Difficult Airway Society defines it as using pressure as a measurement. And then we will go on to look at the flow studies. But flow studies, some people do call those jet studies, but they don't measure pressure, Scott. And so that's where it gets very confusing in this area.
Indeed. So let's try to iron out the message here that we could take from this study and the future work you're doing. Is, for an emergency situation, can intubate, can oxygenate, can intubate, can ventilate, however you want to describe it, are any of the cannula-based techniques a good idea based on your level of knowledge?
It's a big question. It's a very controversial area right now. As you well know, the British Societies of Otolaryngology and Anesthesia have come out this week with a position paper saying that they want front of neck access to be the first attempt using open, bougiated endotracheal tube technique. The Australians, in turn, came out with a position paper 48 hours later saying it really is by individual preference of the practitioner. My feeling about it is this. Even if you know transtracheal jet ventilation in your elective surgical situations, you don't know it in an emergency. The whole issue in can intubate, can oxygenate is usually upper airway obstruction by some sort of mechanism. And that's where jet ventilation or blowing pressure-defined oxygen transtracheally becomes dangerous. So even if you actually are comfortable with the technique as a practitioner, it's not for this patient in front of you, actually. And I think if we are going to practice patient-centered care, not practitioner-centered care, we need to avoid these techniques in emergency, can intubate, can oxygenate, and go for open. Is my feeling what I came out of it. And as a second issue is that we found 42 papers published as letters to the editor talking about different things that you could jerry-rig together, hemodialysis catheters, three-way stopcocks, et cetera, et cetera. And even though they were defined in 42 papers as simple, easy, and quick to oxygenate, no evidence was provided, further making this area of an emergency can intubate, can oxygenate situation really confusing to the practitioner who, as you say, well said, Scott, will do this once in their career. Do you really want to be jerry-rigging stuff together?
Now, Laura, I'm at the point now, we have difficult airway carts in my ED ICU, and we have all the equipment stock for a scalpel finger bougie cricothoracotomy, which is what I've strongly advised our group should be their first method to get this done in these situations. And yet we still have equipment for catheter-based techniques. And I'm at the point where I want to decide, should I just get rid of those and thereby force people to take the first attempt with an open procedure? Or should I change the equipment to stock the best possible cannula and jet ventilation device? And this is totally your personal opinion. And I know you, I don't think you have any conflicts of interest with any of the companies. If I did make the latter decision to continue stocking something, even though I personally disagree with it, what should I stock?
It's an excellent question. There's a few commercially available products on the market right now. To be honest with you, Scott, I think the most interesting product, if you're going to go to a cannula-based technique, which arguably, if you're going to deal with children under the age of 8, you probably should have something because there's nothing available for that age group commercially, as an open technique. I would actually go for the Ventrain device, to be honest with you. Now, that's just been licensed in the United States. And the interesting part about the Ventrain device is it actually has active exhalation via Venturi effect and has a Luer lock adapter. So you can actually attach it to a cannula, but you could also attach it to, say, an airway exchange catheter, if you have one in place, to provide some active exhalation during the inspiration and expiration phases of a salvage technique can intubate, can oxygenate. Temporizing, still have to get a definitive airway. But to me, it has, because of that active exhalation, there's less danger of breath stacking and barotrauma.
I'm so happy you said that, because after looking at all the available devices, that was the one I was going to recommend as well after trying it only on mannequins. I've never placed it on a real patient. But yes, it has some market advantages. It's costly, but it is a well-thought-out device. How about the cannula itself? Would you go with Andy Hurd's Insight 14-gauge AngioCath or one of the more elaborate commercial cannulae?
Having only done this once in an emergency, I must say the cannula IV was never meant for an airway. It was never meant for a cartilaginous cage, as Rich Levitin so nicely calls it. It's meant for a soft vein. And so kinking is a significant issue. Now, it's interesting to me because Andy Hurd actually brings up the point that a 14-gauge catheter is actually readily available. And it's a good point, actually. It's a good point. But there's not a lot of other things for jet ventilation that are readily available that don't actually have the risk of barotrauma. So if you're going to go for readily available devices, you should actually go for an open technique with a bougie and endotracheal tube and a scalpel. But if readily available is the most important thing. But I think you should go for what's best for this technique if you're going to go for a catheter-based technique, which is one of the Teflon-coated, purpose-meant catheters that are on the market, and there's a number of different catheters that way.
Fantastic. So before we move on from the study, is there any other message that I should be taking from it that we should share with the listeners?
Well, I think your point, Scott, about it's confusing about flow and pressure and how about flow-based techniques is a good one. You know, now that we've rolled out the Airway app because we want to see what other people are doing around the world, we want to get their data about what they're doing. Since June, since we rolled out our app at SMAC, we've collected 15 can't intubate, can't ventilate situations worldwide. Three of those are catheter-based techniques, and none of them used jet ventilation. Two of them used 10 to 15 liters per minute, and one of them used 5 to 10 liters per minute as a flow, and one of them failed out of the three. Those are very small numbers. I can't make any conclusions based on that. But it seems that jet ventilation, at least out of the three that we've collected prospectively now, seems to be falling out of favor. So I would get rid of the jet ventilators. I think pressure-based oxygenation, you know, it may have been better when we had no LMAs and we had no commercially available devices. But I think now that it's 2016, it's time to really start pulling away from the guidelines, the things that are a bit antiquated that we really don't use in practicality anymore.
Fantastic. Well, tell us about this Airway app.
Well, the Airway app is an interesting app. It was actually created by Shannon Lockhart, one of my amazing residents here at the University of British Columbia, and I. And what we wanted to do was, instead of a typical app where it's, you know, downloading of information to the practitioner, we wanted to hear from practitioners. As you said, you know, practitioners maybe do this once in their careers. And so we want to capture that experience from practitioners. I mean, some practitioners, particularly my colleagues in emergency medicine, that I speak with may do it more than once, but as anesthesia providers, maybe once. It's very rare. But we wanted to capture that. We wanted to capture that worldwide and have people input their data. But to me, most importantly, we wanted to share that data openly to everybody and really make it free access. Not only, you know, I know that you're a big proponent of FOMED and I'm all about it, but I think the next step to that is actually freely sharing the data as well. So we are currently collating our first 3 months. We're going to have it up on our website, airwaycollaboration.org. And we're really interested from hearing just about regular clinical practitioners and their experience with various devices and what they found to work and not work for them, and then freely share that information with everybody that uses the app and comes to the website.
So if I'm remembering our conversation in Dublin correctly, what right now you guys are collecting is cricothorotomies and awake intubation. Is there anything else that you guys are collecting on the app?
Those were our first two applications because both of them have a high variation of individual practitioner preference. And those two potentially are the life-saving and life-threatening interventions that we do. So we're starting with those. We're going to continue on with some other interventions. In particular, what we're looking for are next rollout will be testimonials of different people. If you find that your product doesn't work for you or works for you like a hot damn, we want to hear from you and what you would recommend, and we'll post that up. Almost a clearinghouse of people's individual clinical experiences with these types of advanced airway techniques.
I love it. Well, this has been a real pleasure to talk to you, Laura. I knew this was going to be fantastic, having seen all the work you're doing. So thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks so much, Scott. I really, really appreciate the opportunity, and your podcast rocks. I just love it.
Okay, so there you go. What's the take-home message in emergency situations where you actually need this technique to save a life? It fails badly. At least when we're talking about the commercially available pressure-based devices. Now, you might say, well, it's going to be even worse in the jury-rigged flow-based devices. Or you might say, well, these might be better because the risk of barotrauma or the connections exploding may be less. I don't know if that's true. My intuition is that it is not, and we shall see. Laura already intimated that she is releasing a second article on the flow-based techniques, reviewing all the extent literature. But my own experience is bad enough opening up a commercial device that's all ready to go when you're using these, oh, connect this to that and that to this, and that, not going to work out so well when your adrenaline levels are super high. So my advice, as always, is use a surgical technique, cut to air, scalpel, finger, bougie, cricothorotomy. And if you'd like to learn that from me and a host of other amazing instructors, then take the Airway Workshop at Das Smack. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT Podcast saying bye-bye.